BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Lennox Barclay wrote this piano piece for the BBC during the Second World War. The corporation's music planners requested a set of short pieces, a couple of minutes each, that could be used on air as interludes after underrunning programmes. One of the staff pianists engaged here at Broadcasting House would be summoned to play a studio piano live to the nation. In the end, Lennox turned what he'd written into his six preludes, of which that was the first. For me, its stylish elegance rather defines the composer. Like him, it's understated, not shouting out, seeking attention. It's an offering that brings delight. The music has an assured, aristocratic quality to it, this from a man descended from one of England's great landed families. And there's a shimmering sense of the continent. Lennox spent much of his early life in France, was bilingual, and became friends with Ravel and Poulenc. Finally, there's an enigmatic edge to the piece. This feels like the work of a human being in search of something. As he composed this, he was reaching a crossroads in a long struggle to balance personal needs against the challenge of a strong faith. I never met Lennox Barclay. My relationship with his music began in 1992, 3 years after his death. I'd been lured away from an exciting, if ultimately directionless, life broadcasting in what was still colonial Hong Kong. I'd been recruited to join a new British commercial radio station, Classic FM. Smile, segue and shut up was the favourite maxim of my new boss. Playing music was paramount. But even though we weren't encouraged to talk much, the presentation team's rather weak grasp of our subject matter soon became clear. I had grown up listening to the Proms on Radio 3. My mother had taken me to the smattering of chamber music concerts that happened each year in rural West Cornwall, and I'd somehow got up to grade 5 in my Associated Board piano exams. At Classic FM, this rather meagre cultural provenance put me quite high up in terms of my musical experience and knowledge. Music journalists loved writing about the howlers we made from day one. Erroneous pronunciations, piano sonatas identified as symphonies, Bach and Bax, Prokofiev and Puccini gaily mixed up. The audience seemed happy and quickly grew, and we'd always made it clear we were about entertainment rather than high art. Nonetheless, it was decided that something had to be done. On his way, we were told, was the man who would sort us out. A few days later, Tony Scotland arrived at Classic's Camden Town premises. Even those on the team who'd only briefly listened to Radio 3 knew who he was, one of a team of revered announcers. Alongside Patricia Hughes and Cormac Rigby and Peter Barker, he'd given Radio 3 elegant gravitas and rich authority. But a desire for change at Broadcasting House had forced him out, and now he was ours. I should say I was just 21 at this point, living in London for the first time, revelling in all the city had to offer, pinching myself to prove I really had landed a prime slot on national radio. Tony was urbane, charming, part of a smart, sophisticated world that I rather fancied breaking into, but had no idea how to go about it. And it turned out he was part of the Barclay family. His partner, though in the context the word still sounded a little exotic back then, was Lennox's second son, Julian. Tony and I, and a couple of other Classic FM colleagues, would lunch weekly at the New Good Fair, a greasy spoon in Camden. Our menu seldom changed, omelette and chips, apple crumble and mugs of tea. And it was there that we started talking about Lennox Barclay. Tony would later write a revealing biography of his father-in-law, but back then he would patiently answer my myriad questions, helping me build up a rich picture of an intriguing 20th century cultural figure. It's easy to put Barclay into that rather full box of neglected composers. That doesn't do him justice. It suggests a world of overly keen fans making unhelpfully grandiose claims about the value and importance of the music written by their hero or heroine. I think Lennox Barclay's music is very fine. It is work that will give huge pleasure to anyone who seeks it out. But for me, the route to it was not notes on the page or even a battered old album. It was the man himself. He might have been Earl of Berkeley, custodian of the Gloucestershire castle and its vast estates, owner of much of Mayfair, but for the fact that his father was born before his parents were married. So from the very beginning, Lennox was a bit of an outsider, nearly an aristocrat, but not. He went to Gresham's school in Norfolk, 14 years before Benjamin Britten, who later becomes part of this tale. At Oxford, Merton College, he read French and Old French. Amongst his friends were W. H. Auden, also ex-Greshams, Cecil Day Lewis, and the novelist Edward Sackville West. Ravel was his first musical hero, and when the Frenchman came to London in 1925, Berkeley was recruited to look after him. He tentatively asked if he might become a student. The answer was no. The person you need, Ravel announced, is Nadia Boulanger. The celebrated teacher, composer, conductor and organist became perhaps the greatest influence on Lennox and his music. He adored her, and as Tony Scotland writes in his biography, she was taken by him, by his good looks, charm, modesty and his good breeding, a quality to which she was always acutely susceptible. On and off, he spent nearly a decade in France, studying with Nadia, dining with Stravinsky, sending back reviews for the monthly musical record, playing tennis with his friend Somerset Maugham at Cap Ferrat near Nice. I remember vividly Tony's description of the final scene of this fantastical Technicolor pre-war existence, Lennox's sad last trip to a grey, empty, frightened Paris in October 1939. If Paris depressed him at this time, so did the state of his friendship with Benjamin Britten, who'd just left England for America with the man who was soon to become his lover, Peter Peers. Berkeley and Britten had also had a kind of relationship, which now came to an abrupt end. It must have been a complicated affair. Ben, the younger man, self-assured, bold, with no doubts about his ability to take on the world, whereas Lennox lacked confidence, didn't believe in himself, saw music as a form of personal expression rather than an art to be exposed to audiences. In 1938, they'd lived together in a windmill at Snape. Ben wanted simply companionship and adoration, writes Tony. They slept in separate beds. Lennox wanted something rather more. It was not an unusual situation, one person wanting more from a relationship than another, but what made life particularly complicated for Lennox was the fact that he had an extra load to carry, the faith that he had embraced when he was received into the Catholic Church, aged 26. That faith became key to his very existence. It's no surprise that many of his finest works are liturgical or inspired by biblical narrative. His Stabat Mater, Missa Brevis and five-part Mass, his setting of The Lord is My Shepherd, performed at least weekly in a cathedral somewhere, as well as major concert hall works, the opera cum oratorio Ruth, and perhaps his masterpiece, The Five Poems of St. Teresa of Avila, written for Kathleen Ferrier and subsequently taken up by Dame Janet Baker. But how did he balance that belief with complete self-awareness of who he was? One of his relationships, by the way, I suspect Lennox would have bridled at that word, but it seems the most useful, was with Alan Searle, a pretty young man from the East End of London who eventually became Somerset Maugham's secretary and companion. After Searle had had a crisis of confidence, he wrote to Lennox for advice. The reply tells us much about Lennox's attempts to balance faith and self. "I am not a particularly religious person myself, but I do believe in it. And if I behave nohow from time to time, it's because I'm very weak and never can resist temptation. But at the bottom of my heart, I believe it to be wrong, though I don't think it's terribly serious." There is in those lines a conundrum. Nohow, i.e. sexual pleasure, equates with moral weakness, yet a bit of fun doesn't seem to be something worthy of too much self-flagellation. To me, growing up in the early 90s, the first sentiment seemed of another age, when homosexuality and sinfulness were pretty much synonyms. And yet I sympathised with Lennox's equivocal answer. I'd come of age when the AIDS crisis was at its height. I was 16 when John Hurt's voiceover scared the nation, warning of a deadly disease with no known cure. Somehow Lennox's vagueness about whether gay sex was okay or bad reflected a dilemma that many young men at that time had to address. In 1944, Lennox met Frieda Bernstein, a young secretary working for the BBC Music Department on Marylebone High Street. Lennox was working there too as a producer, building classical music programmes and trying to interest the commissioners in his own music, like that prelude we heard earlier. He was in a relationship with another man. She soon became aware of the complexities that could lie ahead. "I love him so and can't have him," she told a friend. But when Frieda became pregnant, Lennox married her. Frieda is still alive. When Tony introduced us, it immediately became clear what a loving, honest and happy marriage she and Lennox had enjoyed. Of course, a gay man getting married was, at this point, not unusual, with blackmail and imprisonment real risks until the 1967 Sexual Offences Act legalised sex between men over 21. But ensuring his respectability was not the only reason Lennox married. It brought him the approval of his church and a beautiful young wife he loved and trusted. When news of their marriage became public, Frieda received hate letters from some of Lennox's contemporaries, accusing her of trying to convert him and warning of the consequences. "All Lennox's men friends were convinced I'd tricked him into marriage," Frieda later recalled. "I don't think anyone thought it would last." Perhaps Lennox could have followed the form of many other marriages, publicly together, privately seeking sexual solace away from home. But that was not the route he took. His faith helped him sublimate old desires, and he became a caring husband and loving, proud father of three children. He was undoubtedly helped by Frieda's relaxed attitude towards the friends from his old life, even those who'd been so unpleasant to her. From the perspective of the 1990s, though, all this seemed a bit of an easy way out. Gay rights campaigners were fighting for equality. Legislation to enable same-sex partnerships seemed vital. The idea of a gay man only finding acceptance through marriage to a woman was tricky. It felt wrong. It felt a bit like giving up. And yet, as I grew older, and I suppose more tolerant, I came to understand what Lennox had done. His route wasn't for me, but I began to respect how he'd found a satisfactory balance of self, of family, of faith and honesty, and I found that his story became even more compelling. Back in 1992, there wasn't that much Lennox Barkley on record to listen to. The CD era had not yet embraced the more recherché areas of the repertoire, but gradually I started tracking down recordings of Lennox's music. A few of the works, his Serenade for Strings, the Montjuïc Suite that he co-wrote with Britten, even made it to the airwaves at Classic FM. Then that great and much-missed advocate for English music, Richard Hickox, started recording Barclay's symphonic works with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, alongside music by Lennox's eldest son, Michael Barclay. Soon the budget labels joined in too. The section of the CD store display between Berg and Berlioz was no longer quite so thin. In the end, I became one of those shouting publicly about Lennox Barkley's music, chairing the charitable society dedicated to propagating his works. Many of them are subtle, expressive, deeply satisfying treasures, perfectly representative of the man whose story has accompanied my adult life.